This program is provided by a trusted partner of the church and is educational, inspirational, and uplifting. It does not necessarily represent the official position of the church.
There were a few folks in Nauvoo who wanted to see, to believe Joseph Smith had lived a prophet, but he died a fallen prophet. Brigham Young and the Quorum of the Twelve in Nauvoo, by their actions, testified that Joseph Smith lived and died a prophet.
Coming up next, the last days of Nauvoo.
The Mormon Channel presents the Joseph Smith Papers.
K-Jazz Television, in cooperation with the Church History Department of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, presents this weekly series highlighting the research of scholars and historians as they prepare for the publication of the Joseph Smith Papers. And now your host, Glenn Rawson.
August the 8th, 1844. The majority of church members in Nauvoo voted to follow Brigham Young in the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles. Now, even though that vote was decisive, it was anything but conclusive. There were members of the church who had issues with Brigham Young and the Twelve Apostles collectively. Now, the net result was that dissonant voices arose in Nauvoo that led some church members away from the Twelve. One of those who was disappointed with that conference vote was Sidney Rigdon.
Richard E. Bennett.
And it was a crushing blow to Sidney Rigdon. And he turned bitter after that, turned vindictive against the Twelve, some of whom were his close friends. And he had friends in the Twelve and tried to fight against the Twelve. He eventually left the Twelve no choice but to excommunicate the first counselor in the first presidency.
Ronald K. Esplin.
Now, succession, as a matter of authority, was pretty well settled with the August 8th meeting and the public trial of Sidney Rigdon. But it wasn't settled for those who were at odds with some of the things that Joseph Smith did in the last months or years of his life in Nauvoo. Indeed, succession for these folks became a question of who do we follow? How can we find some way to be Latter-day Saints, if you will, when we believe in the Book of Mormon, we believe in the Restoration, we believe Joseph was a prophet, past tense, but we cannot follow the Twelve.
Those who had been at odds with Joseph Smith now found themselves at odds with the Twelve Apostles. They've been called Mormons in search of Mormonism. They wanted a leader after their own fashion of Mormonism.
Sidney Rigdon was not the, perhaps if you would say, the most challenging threat to the Quorum of the Twelve, or the, shall we say, the most meaningful argument. I think they could handle the guardianship argument theologically quite well. More difficult was going to be the claim of another man who wasn't even a member of the church until 6 months before. You probably know about this. Some people will call this the great pretender. If Sidney Rigdon was the contender, this other man coming forward is considered maybe in some ways the pretender.
That pretender was 31-year-old James Jesse Strang of New York. And his pretension was significant. For a time, he was the most viable counter to the 12 apostles.
Robin S. Jensen.
From New York, he'd moved to Wisconsin. And there he became geographically, he was closer to the center of Mormonism in Nauvoo, and he also heard a little bit more about Mormonism, enough so that he wanted to go investigate for himself. So in early 1844, he travels down to Nauvoo, Illinois, and there he has a personal interview with Joseph Smith, and he investigates Mormonism for himself.
In February of 1844, Strang, who appeared earnest at the time, was baptized a Latter-day Saint by Joseph Smith, who then sent him on a mission to Wisconsin.
So James Strang goes up to his hometown of Racine, Wisconsin, and writes to Joseph Smith indicating that this is a perfect place for a contingent of the Latter-day Saints to move. When Joseph Smith receives this letter, he writes a response. Unfortunately, we do not have either Strang's letter to Joseph Smith or Joseph Smith's response. What we do have is a purported letter written by Joseph Smith to James Strang that dramatically changed the outcome of many Mormons' lives. James Strang received a letter that was dated 18 June 1844. There is a letter in existence at Yale, at the Yale Library, with that date, signed by Joseph Smith. And this letter, which has become known as the letter of appointment, directed Strang to lead the church after Joseph Smith's death.
Most scholars agree that Strang's letter was a forgery, and it was handwriting that became one of the clues leading to that conclusion.
We have not identified this handwriting, but there is one characteristic that makes it suspect. It's block lettering. So often there's cursive script in the 19th century documents, but this is no cursive. It's just each letter written individually, which is fairly uncharacteristic of any document in the 19th century, but especially uncharacteristic of the documents created in Nauvoo.
A small group of Latter-day Saint missionaries serving in eastern Michigan in the first week of August 1844 confronted Strang. He was up there gathering support among small Mormon congregations. One of those missionaries, Norton Jacob, described this alleged letter of appointment that Strang had as having, quote, upon its face the mark of a base forgery, being written throughout in printed characters. Well, Jacob took a copy of that letter and showed it to the 12 in Nauvoo. Strang was excommunicated, but that did not deter him.
In early 1846, James Strang appointed several missionaries to go to Nauvoo. There, he made some pretty significant headway. We have important figures as Johnny Page, who was a former apostle of the church, join Strangism. We have William Smith, the brother of Joseph Smith, joining Strangism. Even Lucy Mack Smith, the prophet's mother, thought a little bit.
Strang gained influence in Nauvoo over a few prominent members of the church, but it was in the far-flung branches of the church where he garnered his greatest success.
And what the Strangite missionaries did is they went through all of the Mormon branches to convert the Mormons. They went where the field was white, all ready to harvest. So it's remarkable to see these missionaries come in and convert scores, hundreds, thousands of people to their cause, we just tend to forget about them because they didn't come west and they didn't make an impact on our history. We forget all about them.
Considering that today Strang's movement has a very small number of adherents, what was it at the time that made him so appealing?
James Strang offered an alternative, claiming the whole priesthood, having a first presidency, receiving revelation, and gathered many people who wanted to have the comfort of being in the orbit of the Latter-day Saint teachings without the things that they were at odds with.
They didn't want to go out west, and they thought, I want to remain a Mormon. I do not want to go out west. Where can I turn? And so many people seemed to turn to James Strang.
There was no question that James J. Strang had charismatic abilities. His personality was a very, very upbeat, cheerful, attractive personality to many people.
He was, before joining Mormonism, was a lawyer. He I think, had that mind of the law that he could argue his case, and he argued it well. There were many people who joined Strangism. This was truly a thorn in Brigham Young's side. The modern Strangite church is so small, we don't hear about the tremendous upheaval it took, this upheaval upon Mormonism. It was so profound that branches split in two, families were split in two.
Eventually, Strang will disgrace himself over, he flip-flops on the matter of plural marriage. Falls in love with his secretary, who will dress up as a man and take with him on his visits to the eastern branches of the Strangite Church, breakoffs from the LDS Church, and passes her off as his male secretary, and eventually he's shot by his own people. And that that group will come pretty well to naught, although there are a few Strangites still around, 300 to 400.
Then there was the matter of the Smith family. While Emma Smith, Joseph's widow, never connected thereafter with the 12, she never made it her business to lead people away from the church.
Emma did not leave the church. There's no evidence that she ceased to believe in the restoration in any respect, in the Book of Mormon, in Joseph as a prophet, in the role of revelation, in the revelations. She was not an opposer, a dissenter, even though she struggled with plural marriage. In the rest of her life of support as a helpmate and as a member of the church, we have no reason to think she was anything but a great Latter-day Saint and a supporter to her husband. And she lived out her life that way. Interestingly, we are kind when we think of Mother Smith staying behind. No one doubts that she remained a Latter-day Saint. And we give her a lot of credit for her role in the Restoration. She stayed behind for some of the same reasons Emma did.
One of the consequences of Emma Smith's decision to stay behind once the church relocated in the West was that it took her sons out of the church.
Young Joseph Smith III will not come West, and eventually will be invited by the followers of the Stay Back movement, which coalesce around that reorganized movement. They'll invite him to become their president of the church, which he kind of reluctantly agrees to do.
Joseph had given some sort of blessing to his children with the possibility that they would have great roles to play in the restoration. In fact, one of the difficulties that Brigham Young had with Emma is that by her staying back, those roles could not be fulfilled. Even in the 1860s, Brigham Young is preaching in Salt Lake. Joseph Smith's sons, David, young David, is one son of promise, certainly Joseph III. If Joseph's sons come in through the gate and receive all of the authority and priesthood blessings we have, they can yet fulfill their roles. And instead of Joseph III or David Hiram, who fulfilled all those roles? Hiram's son is the one who became president of the church by coming in through the gate and through the ranks of the Quorum of the Twelve, becoming eventually president of the church.
While the issue of succession reverberated for decades thereafter, life went on for the saints in Nauvoo. Then, the Illinois State Legislature revoked the Nauvoo City Charter.
The devastating economic, legal, and political impact of the repeal of the charter cannot be underestimated. What does that do? The city is no longer a legal entity. The Nauvoo Legion is no longer a legal militia. There is no police force that's legalized in the city. Brigham Young says, and the saints, we'll have a town. We'll call it the City of Joseph. 1 square mile. At least it'll provide us a little bit of legality under the law. We'll have a little bit of a protection. But for 12,000 people? The writing's on the wall with the repeal of the charter that we're going to have to get out. There's no recourse. The balls that were shot at Joseph Smith were really aimed at the heart of this church. And Joseph Smith's death did not end the church, and so they're going to now try to do it in whatever way they need to do it. And everyone who can see the situation understands that there's no future for the Latter-day Saints in Nauvoo.
While those who murdered Joseph and Hiram Smith represented the objectives of some in the county, it should be remembered that not everyone in Hancock County consented to that violence.
Ronald O. Barney.
A very telling incident took place 26 years after Joseph Smith was killed, when Thomas Sharp, his primary nemesis at the time, gave a speech in front of a number of old Hancock County settlers. And as he addressed them, he said, "I know that there are some of you who are in the audience who did not share our feelings about what happened to the Latter-day Saints." He said, but I want you to know we had to do it. He said, in those days, the blood of the people who were so unfortunate as to have their homes here was hot with excitement. Some things were undoubtedly done by the old settlers and approved by them that had better not have been done. But it must be remembered, the anti-Mormon old settlers of Hancock County felt impelled to take the law into their own hands in order to rid themselves of what they regarded as dangerous and troublesome neighbors. But what we derive from this is that this was a minority in all likelihood, that not everyone who lived in Hancock County shared this aggravation, this extreme aggravation with the Latter-day Saints.
While some took the law into their own hands and tried to make trouble, there were others in Hancock County who, through the law, tried to resolve it. And one of those unresolved legal issues after the martyrdom was the destruction of the Nauvoo Expositor.
Jeffrey N. Walker.
And so we find in the city council minutes of July 1st of 1844, just 4 days after the martyrdom, a discussion about finding a settlement with the Laws, with the Fosters, with the Higbees regarding the destruction of the presses. The city council approves payment of $725 to resolve all civil claims arising out of the Nauvoo Expositor incident. And so, clearly, while there was some exposure, one could certainly have the opinion that the church stayed carefully involved with resolving it, and in fact found a settlement. And so there was never a case brought, a civil complaint brought against the church, against the city, against any of the individuals for the destruction of the expositor.
Joseph and Hiram Smith had been murdered in cold blood while under the protective custody of the state of Illinois. After that, there were some Illinois officials who sought to bring those responsible to justice. Accordingly, in October, a grand jury handed down indictments against 9 members of the Warsaw Militia. Of those 9 indicted, eventually 5 came to trial.
But the 5 that actually will get indicted of importance will be Levi Williams, the colonel over the militia, Aldrich, who is the major, and 2 captains, Grover and Davis, and Thomas Sharp. In the interim, I think the church tries to make some critical decisions of whether it's going to have any involvement in the legal process. And there appears to be somewhat of a concerted effort is determined to not participate. And their concept is that they start using the phrase that they're interested in finding peace, not justice. And that for them to have justice, many believe that it could result in a civil battle, civil war within that county between the anti-Mormons and the Mormons. And so rather than taking a risk of escalating the violence by participating in trying to bring to justice, they decide that they will not participate as a general matter.
Because John Taylor and other principal witnesses refused to testify at the trial, the outcome was just what the Mormon leaders expected in the first place.
Well, the jury gets the case at 11:30. They go for lunch. At 2 o'clock, they come back, acquitting everyone. There'll be no convictions in the case. Now, that case was just over Joseph. The case against Hiram was going to come next. When the June hearing comes for the trial of the same man for the assassination of Hiram Smith, the prosecution never appears. The judge arrives in Carthage. He calls the case. There's no prosecution. He calls it 3 times without them responding, and thereafter dismisses the case. So there is never a trial against the accused for the murder of Hiram.
While the hourglass of Joseph Smith's life emptied, among those things that he wanted most to see before he died was the Nauvoo Temple completed and the saints to receive their temple blessings in it. He also envisioned the saints in the valleys of the Rocky Mountains. Of course, he never lived to see the culmination of these things. But Brigham Young was determined to see those priorities of Joseph Smith fulfilled.
For a dozen years, he sat at the feet of Joseph. In his own words, "An angel never watched him closer than I did. From the first day I came into this kingdom, I never lost an opportunity to sit and learn at the feet of Joseph." Hence, when the time came, he knew both what Joseph's priorities were and, from Joseph's example, had a good sense of how to lead Israel, as he put it, in the latter days. It's this discipleship of Brigham Young and the 12, dedicated not just to Joseph Smith as the prophet of this dispensation, but to his teachings and his program, that allowed them to build on the foundation that Joseph left, so that in very deed they could carry out all the measures of Joseph. The priorities were finish the temple, endow the saints, and then find the promised, prophesied new home for the saints in the West.
The first priority was to complete the temple. Therefore, the call went out for the saints to gather into Nauvoo and work on the temple.
By May, they were able to announce the progress on the temple had been sufficient to announce, "We will begin endowments in December." And indeed, in December of 1845, they began endowing men and women in the Nauvoo Temple in preparation for the move west. Once the temple preparations had progressed to the point where they could start endowing the saints, and they knew they were on track for that, they began meeting privately to prepare for the west.
Undoubtedly, this renewed effort to complete the temple suggested to some anti-Mormons in the area a revival of Mormon influence. They became impatient. They were determined that if the Mormons would not leave, they would drive them out. And so in the late summer of 1845, these extremists began to burn and pillage in the outlying settlements.
And interestingly enough, and to a great surprise of all the opposers, within a matter of a week, Brigham Young capitulated. "Enough, you have defeated us. We cannot win this battle. We will leave." And in fact, what he had done is taken the opportunity to announce what was already in motion and what was already planned for. They would finish the temple, they would endow the saints, they would move to the west. Now, no one had announced a particular date. They had told the anti-Mormons, "We will leave next spring."
Before they could leave, however, the temple had to be completed and the saints endowed in it. The anti-Mormons continued to put immense pressure on the church, making the pace of the work urgent and hastening the delivery of temple blessings to over 5,000 Latter-day Saints.
Now, by the 1st of February, hundreds, indeed thousands, of the saints had been endowed, but not all who wanted to be. Nonetheless, Brigham Young felt such an urgency to depart that he felt he had to close down the ordinances and actually get the wagons loaded and move west. His diary says this: "Notwithstanding, I gave out word that we would not attend to these matters," that is, more ordinances, "the house of the Lord was thronged." He spoke to the ones that were outside waiting for this. "I tell you, brethren, that it will not do. This is not the last temple that we will build. In this house we have been paid well. If we were to receive no more, we shall be satisfied. I'm going to load up my wagon and be away from this place immediately." He walked away some distance, supposing that the crowd would disperse, and then he made his way back to look. He found the place thronged to overflowing. And looking upon the multitude, as he put it, hungering and thirsting for the word, "We commenced sealing and anointing and continued night and day."
Joseph Smith had planned for it. Brigham Young promised it. But the effort of moving several thousand Latter-day Saints 1,300 miles into the western wilderness was a massive undertaking by anyone's standard.
The 12 organized 25 companies, 100 families in each company, and basically said, "Get ready to go in the spring." As winter deepened, the 12 started to hear reports of lawsuits, reports of court challenges, And they knew that they better, for the sake of the people, some of the leaders should get out of town. And in essence, we announce an early departure. Late in January, the 12 decide that they're going to leave not in spring, but as soon as possible. As soon as we've got wagons ready enough to go, as many as are ready can go. And so the Nauvoo Exodus, I think, is best understood using the analogy of a horse, believe it or not. The horse has a head, horse has a body, horse has a tail. The exoduses from Nauvoo really took place in three segments. The head of the horse was the advance company that Brigham Young led in the winter against the plan to leave in the spring, but out of necessity. And in that group, there were maybe 2,500 people, maybe 500 wagons. Most people left according to plan in the spring. The temple was dedicated at the end of April, 1st of May, and we had easily 12,000 people leave in April and May and June, a massive transportation situation at the Mississippi River. And these people then float across Iowa at their own pace, not in a big organized company like Brigham Young's had been, but two families, 12 families, and so forth. The tail of the horse, if you will, was the fall exodus, where there were still several people left in Nauvoo who were poor or sick or had property problems they couldn't solve.
As the Latter-day Saints crossed the Mississippi River to the Iowa side, they turned and looked back at their city. Brigham Young is reported to have said, "When I look at Nauvoo, it is dark. When I look ahead, it is bright." But there were others who felt differently. One of those, Lewis Barney, wrote the following. On reaching the summit between the Mississippi and the Des Moines Rivers, the company made a halt for the purpose of taking a last and peering look at the Nauvoo Temple, the spire of which was then glittering in the bright shining sun. This last view of the temple was witnessed in the midst of sighs and lamentations, all faces in gloom and sorrow, bathed in tears at being forced from our homes and temple that had cost so much toil and suffering to complete its erection. This episode completes our first season of the Joseph Smith Papers and our effort to present the life of Joseph Smith through those papers. Now, next week, we'll begin our second season. Again, through the papers and documents of Joseph Smith, we'll explore in greater detail his teachings, the places of his ministry, and the people he loved. I'm Glenn Rawson. Thank you for joining us.
You've been listening to the Joseph Smith Papers here on the Mormon Channel.